Chapter 5. Dark Core. Early Sunday morning, the Dursleys packed up a grumpy Dudley and a car full of batteries, Game Boy cartridges, and snacks. They were taking Dudley to an amusement park in London, and Harry, as always, was not invited. So as Petunia fussed and soothed her darling Duddykins with a pillow and dessert, Vernon dragged Harry off to Wisteria Walk and Mrs. Fig's house. "Now you listen to me, boy," he growled as they walked. "You are not to associate with this boy of Fig's." Unfortunately for all concerned, after Harry had left Yusuke in the park last week, Dudley had proceeded to pick a fight with him. Despite having numbers on his side, himself, peers, and three more, he'd come home bloody, bruised, and in only slightly better shape than he'd ever left Harry in elementary school. Petunia's shrieks still rang in Harry's ears, some 5 days later. The only consolation was that nobody had pegged Yusuke as a wizard. "Your freakishness and his criminal ways are not to mix. At all." "Yes, Uncle Vernon," Harry answered, carefully not sighing. He'd heard this 10 times already since Petunia had pounded on his door an hour ago. He could almost recite the litany Vernon was spewing. "Blah, blah, blah. You're enough trouble without getting another sorry waste of oxygen in on your antics. You'd think Fig would know better, but then she's willing to put up with you." So on and so forth. Vernon all but threw Harry onto Mrs. Fig's tiny, cat-strewn porch. A short-haired tabby with square markings around its eyes leapt off the stoop and darted away into Mrs. Fig's garden, spooked. Surreptitiously, Harry edged away from Vernon and straightened his t-shirt, then rang the bell. Mrs. Fig answered promptly, opening the door in a worn house dress, bathrobe, and fuzzy slippers. "No, no, back, dearies," she told the cats twining around her legs. "Yes, back. That's right. Mr. Dursley, lovely morning, isn't it? Do come in. Off the stoop, off back, Mr. Tibbs. Let nice Mr. Dursley and Harry in. Back now." Harry dodged the cats, stepping carefully over them and into the dark little living room, and caught sight of Yusuke leaning against the entrance from the dining room. "So, you're the kid Fig's sitting," Yusuke drawled. Behind himself, Harry could almost feel Vernon's hostile glare, as his uncle put up with Mrs. Fig's slightly senile fussing. "That's right," he said warily. Yusuke was acting like he didn't have a clue who Harry was. The door slammed shut, and the atmosphere suddenly relaxed. "Bit old to be babysat, aren't ya?" Yusuke asked, his tone considerably more familiar and friendly. Teasing. "I'm not supposed to associate with you," Harry responded in kind. Yusuke's eyebrow rose. "Yeah?" "Yeah," Harry tried to keep a straight face as he added, "my aunt and uncle said." A long moment of silence, then Yusuke smirked and jerked a thumb toward the backyard. "Wanna spar?" "Sure," Harry answered. Yusuke hadn't said teach, but that had to be what he meant. Harry's hand-to-hand skills, well, weren't. Then he remembered Mrs. Fig. He glanced back towards the foyer to see her reaction. "Well?" she asked. "Such a nice day. Boys should be outside playing." "Go on, then. I'm just a senile old fuddy-duddy. I can't be expected to enforce Dursley's rules." She gave them a tiny grin. "Shoo." Both obediently shooed. The second they were outside, Yusuke pounced. It wasn't very hard, but Harry was sent sprawling. He shoved up blindly, tossing Yusuke off and counterattacked. Yusuke grabbed his arm, twisted it, and Harry found himself eating dirt. "Ain't you never done this before?" Yusuke asked. Harry spat out a clump of grass. "No, I'm better at running." "Go with your strengths, I guess," Yusuke muttered dubiously. Harry ignored that and asked, "What's Professor McGonagall doing here?" Yusuke shrugged, letting Harry up. "Pretending she doesn't know we're all trying to spy, I guess. Where'd you see her?" "On the porch," Harry replied, sitting up and rotating his arm. "Ow. I almost stepped on her," How'd you do that throw? Here, stand up and I'll show you, Yusuke said, waving Harry to his feet. It's easier on people taller than you, but grab my arm like so. Oni-san, how have you been? Hogsmeade has been relatively quiet, with the initial panic over Draco-san's disappearance dying down. The Prophet's reported no new leads and is turning its attention to scandals in the ministry. Rosmerta-san told me this was quite normal. I don't understand their media system very well, I think. Keiko-san sent me a letter. She was most surprised to notice how many non-humans gravitate toward her town. She's a little unnerved, I think. I didn't know whether or not I should suggest that she talk to Shizuru-san. Kurama-san wouldn't want Draco-san to meet his mother, and the next person I would think he'd place Draco-san with is Shizuru-san. Do you know if he did? Yusuke-san has discovered the Howler system and has been sending his updates using them. Genkai Shihan finds them quite amusing, and I think Yusuke-san does too. He's really very loud, isn't he? Yesterday's letter scorched the breakfast table. If this keeps up, I think the neighbors might begin sending howlers in earnest. Kazuma continues his travels through Cornwall. He found a site puddled with dark magic near Torbay and was terribly upset. Or that might have been the fever talking. It turns out that Kazuma is allergic to Cornish pixies. He was very fortunate to have been able to write his letter. I'm taking the train down to Plymouth tonight, so I'm afraid you won't be hearing from me until Kazuma's feeling better. Be well, Yukina. Hiei's hand brushed over his pocket, feeling the crinkle of parchment, the rest of Yukina's letters, none of which mentioned Malfoy except as a topic in the newspaper. Then, frowning, he balled up the new letter in his hand and burned it. A trace of ash, all that was left of the letter, drifted away with the breeze.
And people are still reeling from the Dark Tournament,
Kurama's informant said on Thursday, static buzzing over Kurama's cell phone.
Rumor is there's some pretty ugly shuffling going on behind closed doors with power vacuums all over the place. Nobody's keeping the peons in check.
Effects? Kurama asked.
Petty crime skyrocketed, but something's been taking them out in your area.
Shizuru and her guests, if Kurama had to hazard a guess.
Higher operations have gone to ground. They got more brains than your average thug.
That's not saying much.
Point, but...
the informant warned.
This ain't gonna last forever. Another year or two tops and these guys will quit being spooked.
I'll worry about that then, Kurama said, unlocking his front door. Good work. Your pay's in locker 323 at Roppongi Station. He hung up, not waiting for a reply. I'm home, he called, slipping his shoes off. Welcome back, Shiori replied, her voice echoing from the direction of the kitchen. There are letters for you on the table. Letters? Kurama glanced at the hall table, dropping his cell phone and keys next to the lacquered tray they used for mail. Stacked neatly on it were two envelopes, both made of folded parchment. The one on top bore several Muggle stamps, postmarked from Manchester and labeled for airmail. Kurama picked both letters up, shuffling the two apart to see that the second was devoid of any such additions. He opened the unstamped one first. The Japanese was poorly penned, and the letterhead gaudy in a way that screamed of bureaucracy. He skimmed it quickly, unsurprised to discover that it was from the British Department of Magical Law Enforcement. It requested, in a way that was really just a poorly disguised order, that he present himself to an Officer Morioka at the local police station within the... He squinted at the blotchy kanji. Week. For routine questioning. So, they'd finally gotten around to him. And somebody had, unsurprisingly given the prohibitive cost, cut corners buying their translation charm. Kurama glanced at the date at the top of the letter. He had 2 days left to visit the station. Not quite enough time for another seed-stalking excursion, he thought as he opened the other, stamp-laden envelope, but enough to check in on Draco. The handwriting on the letter inside was Hiei's. Two kanji in the first line leapt off the page at him. Problem. Or not. He read this letter more slowly than the last, muscles tensing as he read. Neville. Indoors. Garden gone wild. Miserable. Bad sign indeed, Hiei. Kurama picked his phone up again and dialed a number one-handed, walking slowly down the hall. Hiei's letters still held before his eyes. He entered the kitchen as someone picked up on the other end of the line. Hello, Suzuki-san?
Kurama-san?
Yes. His mother glanced up from the stove, smile faltering at Kurama's non-expression. Kurama tried to muster a reassuring face for her, but she set her chopsticks aside and turned the stove off, wiping her hands on a hand towel. I'm afraid I won't be able to make that appointment. Kurama twitched the phone away from his mouth. Mother, can you look up the airport's number, please? She already paused in surprise and knelt to rummage through a lower cabinet. Kurama turned his attention back to the phone. Would you mind delivering?
Delivering?
Suzuki asked.
Well, of course. It'll cost more.
And he sounded a bit too cheerful about that.
But I thought you wanted to have a look at the selection.
I did. Something's come up. Had it ever. If you would just choose the best and most broadly useful, I'm sure your skills are up to it. I would greatly appreciate it. Shiori pulled the rarely used book from the cupboard, paging through it with oddly worried glances Kurama's way.
I'll need an address.
May I call you with it later?
Of course. I'll have your bill ready by then as well.
That sounds fine. I'll call you back then. Kurama hung up. Shiori was staring at him. Shuichi, what's wrong? What's this about? Kurama tried to sidestep the question. Did you find that number? She nodded numbly, and Kurama gently pulled the phone book towards him to look. He dialed again and lifted the letter a bit, drawing her attention to it. It's a friend. He's sick, almost slipped out. But he didn't need to twist the truth, did he? In trouble. On the other end of the line, the phone rang. Trouble? Shiori repeated, eyes widening. A second ring, and someone picked up.
Tokyo Narita Airport. How may I direct your call?
Kurama held up a finger, turning his attention to the phone. All Nippon Airways, please.
Please hold.
You know how Father used his magic? Kurama asked. It was a wild guess, but she'd known enough to direct him to the trunk last summer. How he poured his heart and soul into his work, into his spells. Another slow nod. Yes, Shiori said hesitantly. He'd guessed right. The British don't do it like that. What was their problem anyway? They had issues with core magic and non-humans. That was a fact. But as for the underlying reasons, I don't know why. I just don't. I tutored another student. He's home now, and his family's not letting him practice. And he's too strong to just stop, like...
All Nippon Airways, how may I help you today?
Kurama held up a finger to Shiori. Just a second. Ah, yes. I'd like to buy a ticket on the next flight to London.
Shuichi,
his mother wavered. Nobody but Hiei even knows Mother, and he doesn't have a phone. I can get there much faster than a letter, as well as manage the fallout if something goes wrong.
But...
Sir, I'm showing the next flight with open seats at 11:40 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Thank you. I'll need a one-way adult ticket for Minamino Shuichi, coach class. He listened to the clatter as the clerk typed the details in. How much?
145,110 yen.
Shiori stared as Kurama pulled his wallet from his pocket, fetching his credit card.
Shuichi, no, you can't afford it.
Yes, I can, Mother. He read the numbers off as the clerk directed.
Thank you for your business, Minamino-sama. Please enjoy your flight.
Thank you. Kurama hung up, turning back to Shiori. Her eyes were entirely too bright, but no tears fell.
Shuichi.
I'm sorry, Mother. Kurama hesitated a moment, then drew her into a hug. She clung tightly to him. I wanted to stay the summer, he murmured into her hair. I truly did.
But he needs help.
She made a soft, pained sound of agreement, and he pulled away a bit to face her. I'll see what I can do about coming back, but I can't make any promises.
You do what you need to, all right? Don't worry about me.
She cupped his face, a wavery smile ghosting across hers.
My little boy, so grown up.
Kurama squirmed.
Mother, that's embarrassing.
She chuckled sadly.
Mother's prerogative, and you don't really mind.
Well, no, he admitted with mock reluctance. She ruffled his hair.
Mom,
he sputtered, laughing, ducking away.
You'll write to me, she stated, and call when you're in Muggle areas.
Right.
And take some pictures. There weren't any from your whole year at school.
She smiled up at him.
I'll forget what you look like.
Pictures. Right. He held Shiori's gaze for a moment, then awkwardly patted her shoulders.
I have to...
He trailed off, jerking a thumb upstairs. She blinked.
Hmm? Oh, yes, you have a lot to do before your flight. Packing.
Yes. Stiffly, he patted her a last time and made his escape upstairs. Sometimes it was hard balancing what he'd observed of teenage behavior, honest caring towards his mother, and centuries of self-reliance in the Makai. Once in his room, he dug a sheet of parchment from his trunk. May as well be as polite about his reply as Hiei had been with the original letter, and used a ballpoint to neatly ink a short note. Hiei, thank you for the information. I'll handle it. Kurama. He had envelopes in his desk drawer, remnants of his earlier days seeking out informants in Tokyo, before he had a cell phone. Pulling one out, he addressed the letter to Hiei, C.O. Yusuke, at Fig's house on Wisteria Walk. They kept stamps downstairs in a drawer in the hall table, with their hanko seals. He'd take a few and drop the letter in the mail on his way to the police station. After that, it would be a simple matter of faking a complete lack of knowledge about Draco's disappearance. He wouldn't even have to lie. He didn't know Draco was missing, because he knew where Draco was. No one had told him about it. He'd had only the one letter from anyone except the Aurors, and it didn't mention Draco. And he hadn't noticed Draco acting oddly, because, in all honesty, Draco had been behaving perfectly normally for someone in danger from both sides. He'd only seen Draco twice on the train, both times in line for the toilet, and not on the platform at all, because Draco's doppelganger had vanished by then. Kurama sealed the letter, turned out the light, and left. Waiting rooms had the most uncomfortable chairs in existence, Harry thought, rubbing his gritty eyes behind his glasses. How Ginny was managing to sleep in hers, even slumped using Harry as a pillow, he wasn't sure. Molly sat on Ginny's far side, pale and clutching at the girl's limp hand, staring at the scuffed floor. Across from her, Hermione fidgeted, eyes flicking from the Mediwitch's desk to the clock. 2 in the morning, Harry noted absently, fingers twitching without a quill or book in them. Over in the corner, Bill and Percy spoke in low tones, tense and visibly biting back arguments on both sides. The twins hovered between them and Harry, Ginny, and Molly. Nearly 5 hours since George had shown up alone on the Dursleys' doorstep, Harry hadn't known the twins ever got out of eyesight of each other, save for one newt-level class each. He definitely hadn't seen either so tense and sober. It hadn't taken George's coldly spoken silencing charm on Vernon to signal something was wrong. Arthur brought in a tray of hot drinks, silently disentangling Ginny's hand from Molly's and replacing it with a cup of steaming tea. 4.5 hours since the night bus had dropped them and Fred and Hermione off at the dilapidated, closed little storefront that masked St. Mungo's. Since the Mediwitch in lime green robes had walked them personally up to spell damage on the 4th floor. Since Molly had pulled the twins and Harry and Hermione into a clumsy hug and clung for several long moments. 4 hours, and 3, and 1.5, since a meta-wizard had told them they were still running tests to diagnose Ron,
and calling in healer after healer. An hour since the last of the waivers for more obscure experts had been whisked away. Catatonic, not comatose. Or, as Ginny had put it, just sitting there, staring at nothing and falling over when I shook him. Oh, Merlin! No signs of charms, hexes, jinxes, dark magic, or basilisk petrification. Just before midnight, they'd even brought a healer from the first floor to check that Ron hadn't been replaced with a transfigured object of some sort. Nobody mentioned Voldemort. Nobody dared. But this wasn't his style, right? A dumpy little witch brought in another clipboard, handing it to Mr. Weasley after a glance at Mrs. Weasley. "What's this?" Arthur asked, voice hoarse. "Papers for admittance to the long-term ward, sir," the Meadowitch said quietly. The flight to England had been long and dull, the only highlight being a decent set of in-flight movies and two surprisingly edible meals. Kurama had arrived with plenty of time to get through customs and to the train station to catch the last train to Manchester. He slept through the 4-hour journey, carefully on top of his backpack to deter thieves, and found a cheap motel near the station. The next morning, a bit bleary from jet lag, he took a local train to Preston, then a taxi into the mountains, and began to walk. He'd seen Hiei's intended route, with many of the students' homes marked. He could find the way. So it was that 3 days after receiving Hiei's letter, Kurama stood across the road from the Longbottom residence, studying the house and its surroundings with a skilled eye. Heavy masses of ivy clung to the wall, up to the third story, tendrils starting to snake over the window. The garden itself looked more like an overgrown flower pot than a yard. Thick greenery all but unbroken from walls to house, hiding much of the ground floor. Around it, scattered trees leaned noticeably off from vertical, all towards the house. The grass under his feet was entirely too thick, even this far away. Kurama's backpack slid to the ground with a thump, and he slung it between the heavy roots of a nearby tree. Time to get to work, then. It would have to be a slapdash job, though. There wasn't really time to treat it like a proper project. Not that he was out to burglarize the house, but there were certain similarities. First step, then. Ascertain who was home. Neville was a given, considering Hiei's information. But his grandmother wasn't. As for other relatives, the house was certainly large enough to house several, but that was no assurance that there were any. There might be guests, too, if Mrs. Longbottom was the sort of person to invite guests despite her garden's wild state. Kurama circled the house, slowly approaching it from a direction with heavy cover and bad lines of sight from the windows. He fetched up in a crouch against the stone wall around the garden, near the side of the house, and out of sight of the front gate. Cool brick prickled against his back, and he bit his lip. Hiei was right about the unkempt, shattered remnants of anti-demon wards. The sensation was more shocking than anything else, though it would have stung Hiei badly. Right now, though, Kurama's real worry was the trailing ivy and morning glory vines tickling faintly against the sides of his head and neck. Pulling a tiny seed from his hair, Kurama pressed it into the shaded earth next to him and triggered his spy eye vine to sprout. He sent it curling through the ivy, climbing the wall and over, out of sight. He focused tightly on it, on the sensation of his power in it, staring sightlessly up and over his shoulder, as the vine crept through the garden and wormed its way into the house. A tendril of morning glory, growing faster than it had any right to, slowly curved over his collarbone as he worked. Kurama ignored it, automatically schooling himself to calm, with the same skill that allowed him to sleep in the midst of a devil's snare. He turned his attention back to the base of his spy eye, calling forth a leaf to watch inside as he placed the camera buds. The ground floor, a dingy, tiny parlor, scarcely enough room for a prim love seat and two spindly chairs in front of the fireplace, a reading room of some sort, old books and a worn plaid chair, too dark to be used because of the vines over the window. a hallway, a dining room, some attempt at formality with a portrait of a stern man, presumably an ancestor, a kitchen, a kettle over a larger fireplace and an old woman reading the paper by lamplight at a small table. The vine tucked closer, curving back over Kurama's shoulder. First floor. A bathroom, a guest room, another bedroom, this one with several potion bottles on the nightstand and a fox fur on the dresser. A storage closet. Second floor. Locked rooms full of furniture covered in dust cloths. Master, sitting, bath, nursery. A leaf brushed against Kurama's spine as the vine started to loop in on itself. Third floor, and finally the rooms weren't gloomy, with ivy-blocked sunlight. Another bathroom, a hamper of laundry, a threadbare towel drying on a hook. A room of old toys, most boxed away. A second guest room. An open door to Neville's room. The morning glory finished its loop around Kurama's neck and began to double over itself. A second vine started to twist around his arm. So, two occupants. Kurama studied the images in his leaf. One bud, Neville sat on his bed near the window. A second, the half of his room invisible from the stairs seethed with broad-leafed greenery, a massively overgrown lily pad, partially submerged in a tank where Trevor hopped about happily. Soft white blossoms budded, bloomed, and reversed as Kurama watched. A blue flower dropped over Kurama's head, tickling at his face. "All right, that's enough," Kurama muttered, frowning. He pushed it away, only to stop when the move yanked at his scalp. Cursing under his breath, he reached up with his free hand to disentangle the flower's stem from his hair. His momentary irritation triggered the first vine to tighten ever so slightly around his neck. Kurama sighed. Then, pushing with his magic, he countered the new growth and forced it back, freeing himself. On the spy eye leaf, Neville's head snapped up. Kurama froze, instinctively, gaze pinned to the leaf, as Neville hastily shrunk the lily pad down to a size imperceptible in the monitor. With a shy glance towards the door, he tucked it down the waistband of his trousers. Kurama blinked. Did he just... Well, that's one way to make sure your grandmother doesn't confiscate it. After a long moment, during which Neville seemed to realize he hadn't heard his grandmother coming upstairs, his brow furrowed in bewilderment. He slowly turned towards the window and pressed up against it to peer out. He wouldn't see anything, Kurama knew. That window faced the wrong side of the house. But his next move would surely be... Ah. And there he went, heading to the other rooms on the floor. Kurama disentangled himself from the two loving vines, pushing away from the wall. Neville had noticed him. May as well show himself, rather than let the boy think he was stalking him. He stood in the line of sight from the guest room window, in full view, and waited. It was only a minute or two before Neville's face appeared in the window. His eyes widened in shock, and Kurama waved. Neville's hand slowly appeared, and he gave a tiny wave in response. Kurama grinned, beckoning. "Come and play!" As expected, Neville shook his head in dismay. Kurama let his smile fall away, pretending confusion. "Why ever not? It's nice out." And beckoned again. He received the same response, this time more vehement, and cocked his head in more obviously disappointed bewilderment. Then he brought his hand to his chin, eyes narrowing, pretending to think. "I know why you're not out, but let's pretend Hiei never sent me that letter." Kurama pulled a somewhat crinkled sheet of paper and a pen from his jacket pocket, and wrote a quick note. "Whatever is going on, your garden is overflowing with power." Then he slid fingers through his hair, caught a vine seed, and held it out in his hand. It shot out, roots tangling around his hand, stem looping around the note. Kurama stepped back to the wall and pulled himself partway up it, head sticking up over the top. A spy eye leaf lay hidden in the foliage between his arms, unnoticeable from Neville's vantage point. And Kurama kept half an eye on it as he sent the vine, with its note, spiraling up the window. He opened the note for Neville to read, but Neville made several gestures at the window, mimed opening it, then shook his head. Not allowed to open the window? Charmed shut? Alarmed shut? There was no way to know, and Kurama was much too far away to see if Neville wrote on his own parchment inside. However, Hiei's cat had gotten in, somehow, and non-flying species tended to neglect their roofs, so... Kurama squinted at the roofline. A hole in the roof would have been noticed with the first rain, but perhaps there was a gap under the eaves. He sent another tendril sliding up the house to poke wildly at the juncture between wall and rooftop. Inside, where Neville couldn't see, he ran the spy eye up a dark corner and over the ceiling, looking for entry into the attic. A trap door in the hallway provided access for the spy eye. A gleam of light behind the chimney showed Kurama where Yuki had snuck in. He sent the note following the seeking vine outside, balling it tightly and squeezing it in through the crack. Neville turned away from the window, and Kurama shrank the spy eye hastily out of the attic. A moment to lever the trapdoor up and dangle the rather worse-for-wear note into the hallway, and Kurama felt a sharp tug on the end of the vine. He went with the tug, growing the vine, and Neville reappeared in the window, with note in hand. He scribbled on the paper, but didn't let go for the few minutes it would take to let the ink dry. When he did, holding the paper up pointedly and letting go, Kurama reversed the process, and pulled the note back outside and down to read it. He frowned at what it said, and wrote back, repeating the process. By the time Neville's grandmother called up for him to come down for tea, Kurama had found out far more than he ever wanted to know about Gryffindor's stubbornness. Whatever is going on, your garden's overflowing with power. What are you doing here? I thought you went back to Japan. I did. You didn't answer my question. I've been looking at your wall here. The vines tried to grab me. This isn't healthy, Neville. Didn't Hiei tell you? Tell me what? Gran doesn't want me learning dark magic. I'm grounded, and I'm not supposed to be talking to you. Dark magic? What dark magic? And why not? Core magic. Gran says it's demonic, so it's dark. And you're that Slytherin who's been teaching me. What brought this on? You've been learning all year, and it's not dark. There are demons with healing powers. Does that make healing magic dark? And I'm sorry I'm in Slytherin. It's really very isolating in there. She didn't really believe it until I put vines around my bed. And I didn't ask about that. And I'm sorry you're in Slytherin too. This really isn't very healthy, Neville. How long are you grounded for? The whole summer. That's insane. Sneak out with me. I can't do that, Kurama. Why not? I'm not allowed. So, I wouldn't ask if it weren't important. I'm in enough trouble. No. You certainly are, but it's not your gran I'm worried about. Look at your garden. Gran's too old to take care of it, and it's been a wet summer. You don't seriously believe that. This isn't natural growth, Neville. Then it won't last. It'll calm down when term starts. That's 6 more weeks. It's scarcely been 2. I'll last. And Gran's calling me. I guess I'll see you in school. You'll not find this till you come back, but of course you'll last. I'm not so sure about your house. They'd lost Chu somewhere between the liquor stand and a booth selling shaved ice, which Shizuru had dragged Draco in line for. Thank you, Merlin, Draco thought to himself, half wilted in the lingering summer heat. He hadn't known places could get this hot. It felt like he was standing in the steam off a boiling potion, despite the sun sinking towards the horizon. Perhaps he could dump the ice over his head. He glanced sidelong at Shizuru. Then again, maybe not. Several teenage girls in brightly patterned robes and contrasting wide sashes pushed past him, giggling and eyeing his blonde hair. Draco edged back, bumping against Shizuru. Muggles. Ick. He turned away, but there was nowhere to look in the crowd of festival-goers that wasn't packed with muggles, who seemed to be congregating near a high platform set up nearby, topped with a massive drum sitting on its side. A petite woman, carrying two short batons and wearing clinging black shorts and a loose red wrap shirt, pulled herself to the top, sparking a round of applause. She bowed to the audience, transferred the batons to each hand, and stood before the drum. The first hit throbbed with power. A witch! Draco stared, barely noticing as the line moved. The woman was a witch, sending waves of magic pulsing outwards with every beat. A witch blanketing the festival with power. For what purpose, Draco didn't know. He didn't care. It brought the festival to life in a way that the bright colors and whirling crowd didn't. It was magic, strong and warm and vibrant. Japan suddenly, for a heart-stopping moment, felt like home. Then a cone of shaved ice was shoved under his nose, and the moment vanished like a popped bubble. Draco blinked at the brightly colored snowball, a red plastic straw sticking cheerfully from it. What? Take it, Shizuru said, all but dropping it in his hands. Draco nearly fumbled it, only his skill as a seeker keeping the cone upright and unspilled. Then looked up at her. She met his eyes for a long moment, expectantly. My treat, she finally added, pointedly. A familiar gleam of, I will enforce manners with a fist if necessary, in her eye. Thank you. You're welcome. Draco turned away from her vindicated expression, biting back considerable indignation, and attacked the treat. It was sweet, cold, and tasted almost entirely unlike strawberries. Shizuru unsubtly guided him away from the drummer witch, past more stands selling sizzling foods, and booths with buckets of fish, t-shirts, and trinkets in color palettes that would make Dumbledore's tailor hex himself out of sheer envy. Children shrieked in glee, playing games and toting plastic baggies of prized goldfish about. The sound of the drum faded away, replaced by modern music blaring from a radio van and stage at the next intersection. The crowd thinned, streetlights flickered on overhead as they turned the corner, a grassy strip opening up between the cordoned-off streets and the concrete slope down to the river. More muggles were here, families crammed on blankets, bits of debris scattered about, sputtering radios playing a cacophony of different stations. Balloons bobbed above empty strollers, their occupants giggling or howling under caretakers' watchful eyes. Different from wizards? Shizuru asked abruptly. Draco drew himself up, swallowing the last of his shaved ice. Of course, he sneered. Proper wizards were far more impressive and less plebeian. A bit of wrapping blew over his foot, and he kicked it irritably away. And much less plastic-happy. Shizuru made a soft sound that didn't resemble agreement in the least, and pointed him at a trash bin. They didn't exchange any more words through the remainder of the twilight, or the less-than-impressive fireworks display. The soundtrack for it, played over the many sputtering radios, struck Draco as a novel concept, But the display itself came only in circles and ovals, not so much as a triangle, much less dragons. Just before the finale, Shizuru turned to him with a put-upon sigh. "You're bored," she stated. Draco refrained from rolling his eyes. It had taken her this long to notice. He'd been bored the whole summer. May as well leave then. Better to miss the crowd. The train back to the Kuwabara's neighborhood was nearly empty, and the platform silent and dark. Shizuru looked around after they got off, gaze flicking around the lifeless streets. A long moment passed as she tapped a cigarette out of her pack. Then she said, "The heat must have broken a generator somewhere. Cast a light spell." Draco snapped his head around to stare at her, aghast. "Among muggles?" "Just do it, Draco-san," she mumbled tiredly, lighting up. "Anybody looking will assume you've got a flashlight." What? But Draco didn't say this, instead pulling his wand from his pocket in something of a daze. Magic. To do magic. Over the halls. Out in public. Wait. They won't detect it? It hadn't been an issue within Malfoy Manor, but off the grounds was a different story. Shizuru pinned him with a withering look. "You're in Japan. We don't bother here." "Really?" Draco suppressed a grin, filing that information away for later. Maybe he could cast a glamour and hide from both Voldemort and Kurama in Japan then, away from Shizuru. After he had a bit of time to plan it out, of course. "Lumos," he murmured. His wand sparked, the tip glowing a cool white, and Draco angled it downwards at the pavement. They headed out into the inky night. Their footsteps echoed off the concrete fences lining the streets, a small stretch of single-family homes between the station and Shizuru's apartment. There were no cars parked on the street here, all of them neatly under flimsy shelters within the property gates. If power was the subliminal sign of wizarding places, noise was the sign of muggle places. The hum of their fizzling lights and air-cooling boxes, their photo albums and plumbing, had been completely unnoticeable until Draco set foot into a muggle neighborhood without it. No lamps or candles burned in the windows, nobody sang, nobody laughed, no babies cried. Nothing moved save for Draco and Shizuru, not a flicker within the houses or a soul outside. It was as if muggles had forgotten how to exist without their electricity. Shizuru finished a cigarette and started another from the glowing ember of the first. Something rustled. Draco leapt back, knocking into Shizuru, eyes flicking up at a wall to see. "Oh, cat," he murmured sheepishly. He was getting too keyed up. He pulled away from Shizuru, took a step, and nearly ran face first into a row of 6-inch fangs. Draco flung himself backwards, tripping over his own feet and falling flat on his back, and the monster lunged. Shizuru fell into a crouch between them and blew a stream of smoke into its face. The beast screeched. What the hell had she done? Rearing up, twisting away, and swinging blindly at Shizuru with 4-inch claws. She ducked, falling half onto Draco, and blew more smoke at it. "A hex would be appreciated right about now, foreigner," she shouted, before shoving against Draco. They rolled away in opposite directions. The monster leapt to its feet with a glass-shattering roar, a whip-like tail lashing as it twisted towards Draco. "Oh, shit!" He cast the first spell he could think of, a jelly-legs jinx, and the monster collapsed again, thrashing. Directly on the other side of the monster, he saw Shizuru lunge, spinning a kick at its head. The tail whipped around and smacked against her balancing leg, knocking her down once more. The beast threw itself at Draco, claws gouging tracks into the sidewalk, maw gaping. "I'm gonna die," Draco thought, flinging his arms instinctively before his face. Something crashed numbly against the length of his arm, and the beast screeched again, this time more muffled. No searing pain lanced over Draco, as he remembered from the maddening hippogriff of his third year. He peeked between his arms. The monster's mouth was packed with crystal. It shook its head, screeching that muffled shriek again, backing up a step. Then Shizuru reappeared, an arm locked around the monster's neck, stabbing her cigarette between its eyes. The crystal in its jaw shattered under the beast's shrieks. It thrashed wildly, flailing and bucking, and Draco scrambled hastily out from under its claws. He stared as Shizuru clung to the beast, as it smacked her against the ground and wall, roaring. A claw snapped around, cutting deep into her already blood-stained leg. Then it stiffened, red eyes widening, and collapsed. Shizuru stayed there a minute more, breathing hard, tense and waiting, but it didn't move again. Finally, she dragged herself off the carcass, pushing her hair out of her face, and met Draco's eyes. "Exciting enough for you?" she asked tartly.